Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is being recorded for the listening week that begins March 23rd, and your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This week's sources include thegrio.com, blacknews.com, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, MIT Technology Review, something called Nice News, and possibly others. First, an article from the Wall Street Journal, archived from the February print edition. This was written by David M. Schreibman. It is a book review on The Real Hoosiers by Jack McCallum. Storming the Court. In the 1950s, Crispus Attucks High School had few resources but two secret weapons, a future NBA Hall of Famer and a coach who inspired the team to overcome obstacles. Back in 1986, when a Hoosier was the NBA's most valuable player, Larry Bird, reared in French Lick, Indiana, educated at Indiana State, Americans flocked to the movie Hoosiers, a feel-good film starring Gene Hackman, Dennis Hopper, and Barbara Hershey about a tiny high school that defied all odds to win the Indiana State Championship. The film, inspired by the Milan High School squad that won the state championship in 1954, opens with a glimpse of a rural crossroads, two young people shooting balls at a hoop affixed to an old white barn, DeSoto automobiles with their distinctive grills cruising a picturesque set of downtown blocks, a portrait of an old America where the floors of the high school glistened with wax, the girls wore long plaid skirts, and the male hoopsters wore short pants on the hard court and performed their foul shots with underhand thrusts. It's a wonderful movie, as Frank Capra might say, capturing the magic that comes from a leather ball and an iron hoop and from a stolen kiss between a grisly high school basketball coach and a comely school teacher. So wonderful, in fact, that the American Film Institute selected it as one of the best sports film of all time, and former Vice President Mike Pence, born in Columbus, Indiana, proclaimed it the, quote, greatest sports movie ever made. The story is well-loved, and the accolades are well-earned, but there is another Hoosier story that deserves to be known, as moving as the films, and as worthy of mythic status. The real-life tale of an Indiana high school team that won the state championship in 1955, a year after the big victory portrayed in Hoosiers. As Jack McCallum tells us in The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks, High School is segregated, Crispus Attucks High School in segregated Indianapolis didn't have an even, remotely respectable gym, and its neighborhood and atmosphere bore little resemblance to those of the movie's Hickory High School. Yet, it won two consecutive Indiana state championships with every bit as much grit and resilience as the movie's now legendary team. There is a star to this story, too, if not of the strictly Hollywood variety. Oscar Robertson, known to millions as one of the great pro players of the 1960s and early 70s, even considering the achievements of his professional career, Robertson's most treasured moments came in the years he played under Ray Crow at Crispus Attucks, where he once scored 62 points in a single game and recorded 1,231 points in three seasons of play. Robertson and Crow are the central figures in the book The Real Hoosiers, but the narrative adroitly unfolded by Mr. McCallum, a veteran sports writer whose last book chronicled the Los Angeles Lakers and the Golden State Warriors, widens out to convey the particulars of the time and place, the mid-1950s, just after the Supreme Court ordered the desegregation of the nation's schools, and mid-century Indiana, a state in which the Ku Klux Klan was experiencing a resurgence and, at one time, might credibly have claimed the allegiance of the entire Indianapolis School Board. Crispus Attucks High School was, in Mr. McCallum's bracing description, quote, built near a confluence of three fetid waterways, built to keep blacks in their place, built by haters, built to fail, end quote. In making history, the Attucks players rewrote the customs, the rhythms, and the character of the game in a basketball-mad state. Led by Robertson, the great-grandson of an enslaved man and the descendant of a southern sharecropper family that traveled north to Indianapolis in search of work and opportunity, the Attucks Tigers played a disciplined brand of basketball that combined two of Crow's core principles with relevance beyond the court, self-control and ethics. He preached, quote, be right without fear. Unfair victory is bittersweet, end quote. As an Attucks sophomore, Robertson, not yet the Big O of Hall of Fame legend, was what Mr. McCallum calls, quote, an unlikely agent of chaos, with an unusual get-the-hell-out-of-the-way style that was both an act of aggression and a work of art. From season to season, his leadership role increased, along with his stature. By the time he arrived at the University of Cincinnati in 1957, he was a phenom. Quote, a kid who, from his earlier days, thought like a quarterback, and a kid who seemed to bypass apprenticeship, end quote. Almost musical in his movements. Mr. McCallum says, quote, he was Miles Davis, an artist who blew with the cats on 52nd Street, but was also schooled in the rudiments at Juilliard, end quote. Robertson and his teammates played against both tough opponents and an open secret obstacle, refereeing, which gave white teams a quiet but distinct advantage. Robertson had challenges at home, too. A parental divorce and a forced move because the city fathers agreed to bulldoze his neighborhood so a hospital could expand. The pretext was redevelopment or urban renewal, two terms prominent at the time and in disrepute today, but the subtext, also prominent and in disrepute, was slum clearance, displacing 10,000 people, almost all of them black. All of the players on both teams in the 1955 final also were black, solving the racial officiating problem for sure. And so when Attucks defeated Roosevelt, parentheses, from Gary, only a decade after blacks were first allowed to play in the tournament, two landmarks were reached, Attucks was both the first black school to become state champs and the first winners from Indianapolis. The Indianapolis Star called it the top story of the year, edging out a fatal crash at the Indianapolis 500. A year later, the Attucks Tigers, champions again, were the first undefeated basketball team in state history. The team's success changed the high school even as it coaxed Indianapolis and its broader culture toward change. Money from ticket review flowed to the school, enough to underwrite a new printing press and equipment for vocational education classes. It also helped the school sponsor golf and tennis teams when those sports were not part of the vision of black students, who were certainly not welcome in the white-only clubs where those sports were played. Black businesses in the area began to flourish. People experienced a new sense of possibility and hope. And the Big O himself? When on January 9th, 1958, he scored 56 points for the University of Cincinnati against Seton Hall, Robertson was asked whether that Madison Square Garden game was his biggest thrill. He answered, quote, nah, and readers of The Real Hoosiers will recognize that he was speaking the truth. He goes on, "My biggest thrill was helping Crispus Attucks win 2 Indiana state championships." End quote. He and his Tigers were indeed the real Hoosiers. Next, we turn to the Wall Street Journal, this also archived from February print edition. This is a review of a book on some music. The article written by Brad Lighthouser, titled Singing America's Songs. The book, For You, For Me, by Bruce Hubbard. Although I'd never heard of him, I was taken with his smile. I was browsing through new releases in the classical CD section. This was back in those quaint pre-Amazon days when you found your music at a local store, perhaps with the proprietor's counsel. The artist's name was Bruce Hubbard, and the album was called For You, For Me, Songs of Copland, Gershwin, Sondheim, Berlin, Kern, Bernstein. Orchestra of St. Luke's, led by Dennis Russell Davies. The CD's cover photograph suggested somebody who'd just finished performing, or was preparing to perform. The bow tie to his tux was unfastened. The grin was effervescent. I took a chance and made my purchase, thereby ushering into my life an album that now feels close as family. It was Hubbard's debut, and so aglow, so rich with promise. It was also his farewell. For You, For Me was released in 1990. He died the following year at the age of 39. Little about his life is available online. He grew up in a large family in Indianapolis and studied music at Indiana University. He was an operatic baritone who sang at the Met, Glyndebourne, Houston Grand Opera. He was black, and his most prominent roles were of black characters, parentheses, Joe in Showboat, Jake in Porgy and Bess. The critic Randall Jarrell once defined a great novel as one that, quote, does a single thing better than any other book has ever done it, end quote. By these lights, For You, For Me is a great album. I know of no other that makes the whole humming, snapping expanse of Tin Pan Alley, indeed the great American songbook, sound so of a piece. And today, when our country feels so dangerously divided, the album is all the richer for its tacit claims of a shared musical and cultural identity. A shared musical and cultural unity. Tin Pan Alley's golden age is often said to have run from 1925 to 1950. Given how spectacular a quarter century of song that was, both melodically and lyrically, it's hard to imagine with the conventional wisdom. The songwriters thought they were coining mere hits, but they were composing standards. Still, all such eras have fuzzy borders. Parentheses. I'd opened the Golden Age in 1914 with Jerome Kern's They Didn't Believe Me, and Leave open-ended the termination. In parentheses. Many of the popular songs from For You, For Me originated in Hollywood and on Broadway. The album's earliest pop song is Irving Berlin's Always, composed in that climactic year of 1925. The most recent, Leonard Bernstein and Alan J. Lerner's Cena from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, arrived a half century later. That's quite a span, extending from a year when Henry Ford's Model T was still chugging off the assembly line to one where the moon landing was old news. Despite the distance, what's striking about the 20th century songs on For You, For Me are their likenesses rather than their differences. That's the power of Hubbard's artistry. The immediacy of his voice, the verve of his interpretations, he sounds paradoxically both fresh and timeless. The paradox grows especially pointed during the album's first 10 selections devoted to Aaron Copland's old American songs. Copeland created these in the early 50s, the offspring of research into the 19th century sheet music collected at Brown University. Some of Copeland's selections, At the River, Simple Gifts, The Lullaby, The Little Horses, are longtime favorites. Others are fairly obscure, but all 10 are irresistible Americana. And their roots go back even further than you might suppose, colon. Joseph Brackett, creator of Simple Gifts, was born the year George Washington stepped down from the presidency. All the more impressive, then, that For You, For Me feels from first to last like one organic entity, variations on a single national refrain. The, quote, old American songs have generated many likable recordings. Marilyn Horne, Cheryl Milnes, Thomas Hampson, Samuel Ramey, especially notable is William Warfield, and the composer conducting, with the composer conducting. But none matches Hubbard, who brings to the melodies so triumphal an emotional range, and every emotion convincing and compelling. He is by turns devout, sly, playful, joyous, yearning. If I could keep only one cut on For You, For Me, it might be Bernstein's Gorgeous, A Simple Song. Parentheses. Actually, you can retrieve the whole album via Spotify or iTunes. In parentheses. Or perhaps Shenandoah, partly because the waterway it glorifies. More parentheses. Hi-ho, I'm bound away across the wide Missouri. Offers an analog for the forceful flow and roll of the entire album. Hubbard's early death strikes me as a harrowing loss, given how fine are his few recordings of Gershwin. I envision an alternative world in which he persisted in good health, eventually singing Porgy at the Met, the Porgy of my lifetime. Yet our collective loss would have been still greater had Hubbard not lived to produce For You, For Me. It's rare for a single record to convey so complex a musical personality in all its branching wholeness. But listen enough times to his soul album, and you'll probably come to feel you know Bruce Hubbard quite well. If so, answering the smile on the cover of For You, For Me, you can't help but like him. And as your reader, I'll apologize, that was not a book review, but a review of this album. Once again, by Bruce Hubbard, For You, For Me. And it is apparently available on Spotify and iTunes. Moving next to thegriot.com, another basketball article, since March Madness has just begun. This one's written by Darren Snyder. It was published in January of this year, January 22nd. Howard basketball players shoot hoops while studying for a PhD and law school. At first glance, Howard basketball players Seth Towns and Joshua Strong don't seem to have much in common. Towns is a 6'9" forward who was a highly recruited prep player out of Columbus, Ohio. He first attended Harvard, where, as a sophomore, he was Ivy League Player of the Year and AP All-American Honorable Mention. Strong from Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, is a 6-foot guard who wound up at Division II Minnesota Duluth. He was the sixth man as a freshman before starting 14 of 36 games as a sophomore when his team advanced to the NCAA Elite Eight. Their backgrounds and acclaim are as noticeable as their height difference, but they're similar in stretching, quote, student athlete to the maximum while relishing an HBCU journey. Towns, as a 26-year-old doctoral candidate, and Strong, as a 21-year-old law student. Strong graduated high school with 58 college credits and earned his bachelor's in 2 years, summa cum laude, last spring. After gaining admission to Howard's law school, he contacted head basketball coach about joining the team. He won the coach, Blakeney, over by excelling at summer pickup games, but Howard Law would happen regardless. Strong told the Washington Post, "I always had a passion for social justice. I guess early I kind of conceptualized law as the way to attack that. I was always smart, and people would say, 'Oh, you're going to be a doctor, engineer.' Well, how am I going to help black people?" End quote. Playing Division I basketball and studying law usually doesn't mix, as each activity has heavy workloads and time commitments. But when Strong was in middle school, he read about Seton Hall's Braden Anderson, who is believed to be the first Division I men's basketball player to simultaneously attend law school. Strong said, quote, "I just think that, like, you have to be strong-willed. As a black man, they're going to try to break your will. I've got to know what I believe. I need to be a lawyer so I can help my people," end quote. Towns is also on a mission after injuries nearly ended his playing career. Knee and back surgeries cost Towns his last 2 years at Harvard, where he earned an undergraduate degree. He transferred to his hometown school, Ohio State, and earned a master's degree, but medical issues limited to one season, 2020 and 21, in 3 years. He voluntarily sat out last season, thinking his basketball days were behind him. Once an NBA prospect, he got the itch again last year and filed an NCAA waiver to play at Howard as an eighth-year senior. Towns told the Columbus Dispatch, quote, "I think I have restructured my relationship with basketball. It is much healthier now. I'm not saying I put my entire identity into basketball, but man, it was hard because that's kind of the only professional aspiration I've had. Everything else was kind of subsidiary to that. Now, I think I've released myself from the need to play at whatever level. I'm very grateful I'll have another chance to play, and I love the sport and all of that, but I would say my connection to it isn't as unhealthy as it was before," end quote. Enrolled in a doctoral program in English literature, Towns is the NCAA's oldest basketball player. He said choosing his third school was an easy decision. Quote, "I knew off jump that I wanted to go to Howard if I had any eligibility left. I feel like the value of something like attending an HBCU isn't always seen clearly. It's ours to build, ours to protect, and ours to cultivate into this huge, magical thing," end quote. Towns leads the team in rebounding and assists, and he's second in scoring. He wants to help the Bison win the Mideastern Athletic Conference and reach their second consecutive NCAA tournament, but he also wants to help with larger concerns outside of sports. While playing at Ohio State in 2020, Towns kneeled during the national anthem after a childhood friend was shot and killed by a police officer. Earlier that year, Towns was handcuffed, taken into custody during a rally to protest George Floyd's murder. Afterward, he stressed the need for activism. Towns said on ESPN, quote, "There is a huge dilemma in this country right now that needs to be addressed. I won't shut up. I will continue to use my voice to speak out for the people who are unheard." He went on, having a voice doesn't even mean speaking. I'm talking about actions, going out and performing your duty as a member of this democracy. Athletes have a unique platform to speak up for what's wrong and be a voice of the people, but everybody has a responsibility in this," end quote. A sense of duty and the quest for black excellence drew Towns and Strong to Howard, parentheses nicknamed the Mecca, after beginning their academic careers at Harvard and Minnesota Duluth, where black students are 6.21% and 2.11% respectively of the student bodies. Towns told the Washington Post, quote, "The HBCU experience has been everything I hoped it would be. I've enjoyed the classes, but beyond that, I've really enjoyed just getting into discussions about everything that's going on in the world. I'm learning all the time, and it invigorates me every day," end quote. Still reading from The Griot, this is also written by Darren Snyder. It was posted February 26th. Howard, breaks the ice with the nation's first HBCU figure skating team. The inaugural competition spotlighted Howard's effort to build and recruit skaters. Howard recently became the only HBCU among more than 100 schools with a collegiate program under U.S. Figure Skating, the national governing body for the sport. The Bison made history Saturday when they competed in the Blue Hen Ice Classic at the University of Delaware. Princeton, North Carolina State, Maryland, and South Florida were among the schools that participated in the event. Howard skating coach Joel Savory told the Griot, quote, "It was our inaugural competition, and all of our kids skated amazingly. It was just an absolutely wonderful event," end quote. Savory told the Bison, Savory said the Bison took 9 skaters and they demonstrated specific skills in team maneuvers. He said junior Maya James competed and placed 5th in a solo competition that featured 11 schools. Savory said, quote, "That was really great, especially coming in as a brand new school. We are really proud of them because there were a lot of schools participating. It was a great starting point for Howard University," end quote. The process began over a year ago when James and a fellow student, senior Cheyenne Walker, explored the idea of starting a school figure skating team. Both had skated since childhood, but chose Howard over other schools that had figure skating opportunities. James told the U.S. Figure Skating, quote, "I just missed the sport, honestly. I didn't really skate that much during the pandemic. I stopped skating for like 2 years. As I was coming to college, I also saw a lot of the U.S. collegiate Instagram pages and how they went to competitions and how the competitions looked so fun and welcoming," end quote. James learned about Walker during winter break in 2022 and suggested they join forces to build a skating team at Howard. That's where Savory came in. A national figure skating coach in the Washington, D.C. metro area, he is the CEO and founder of Diversify Ice, an organization that sponsors and supports figure skating opportunities for minorities across the country. James reached out for help, and Diversify Ice jumped in, working with the school and USFS to ensure a smooth process in Howard's registration for an official team. They held a kickoff event in October, dividing attendees into students ready to compete right away and students looking to build their skills. Many schools have their own ice rink, but Savory must book time at several area rinks for Howard to use, including outdoor facilities. He's assisted by coaches Denise Vieira, Megan Williams-Stewart, and Jordan McCreary, who bring a wealth of national and international experience. Savory said, quote, "We literally took some students from square one. We are so happy and thrilled to work with them. Having a coaching staff that looks like them really makes a difference because we're able to understand the same experiences, different body types, and even styles of music that come across better. To actually establish an HBCU team is groundbreaking, and we hope to get other HBCUs and minority-serving institutions, too," end quote. The team has a number of skaters set to graduate in the spring. Recruiting efforts are ongoing, with some prospects needing information as much as coaching and mentoring. Savory's goal is to increase awareness at all levels, including K-12 organizations that can feed college programs and national clubs. Moving now to nice news for our next article or two, and I want to tell you a bit about this source first. Nice News launched in February 2022 as an email digest that could be read over a cup of coffee. It has since grown into a safe space to catch up on uplifting news that might otherwise be missed. Through these stories, we hope our readers can see the world through a more optimistic lens. Meet Jonah, the 15-year-old crocheting prodigy who donates his profits to Ethiopian kids in need. This is written by Lauren Hando, and it is archived, was published originally last June. Many might see crocheting as a hobby for older generations, but 15-year-old Jonah Larson is a self-taught prodigy in the field. He's been crocheting since he was just 5, with hopes that the meticulous craft will help prepare him to be a surgeon one day. The teen from Wisconsin has gained real traction on social media in recent years, going by Jonah's Hands online. Quote, "After a very hard, busy, chaotic day in this busy world with school, it's just nice to know that I can come home and crochet in my little corner of the house while sitting by the one I love most, my mom," end quote, he told NPR back in 2019. Perhaps even more impressive than his crocheting skill is Jonah's altruistic spirit. He donates some of his creations and the profits he makes from selling them to Wisconsin-based nonprofit Roots Ethiopia, which benefits the Ethiopian orphanage where he was adopted from at 5 months old, according to Today magazine. His GoFundMe has garnered over $48,000, half of which will go directly to the organization. Per the Roots Ethiopia website, it works with communities, quote, "to improve schools, educate children, and enable livelihoods," end quote. The other half of the money he's raised will help fund a visit back to the village where he was born and help support his crochet business and future education. Quote, "I was adopted from a very poor and rural area," end quote. Jonah, decked out in a colorful crocheted turtleneck, shared on Good Morning America earlier this year, and he added, quote, "When my mom and dad went to get me, the caretakers at the orphanage, when they put me into my mother's arms, they said, 'Don't let him forget his roots,' or 'Don't let him forget where he came from.' And my mom and dad have most definitely kept that promise," end quote. With the help of his supporters, Jonah was able to provide 2,000 kids in that area with a library, a science lab, a new set of restrooms for the female students, and classroom desks. The high school student went on to discuss his future charitable goals, sharing that while, quote, "academics are super important," end quote, "being able to enjoy extracurricular activities is too," he went on, quote, "so our next step is to give them a soccer team with uniforms, shoes, and soccer balls, because they currently have none of those materials," end quote. Jonah looks out for his fellow crocheters as well, providing free patterns on his website and uploading tutorials to his YouTube channel, where he teaches his nearly 150,000 subscribers how to make everything from cable socks and cardigans to beanies, dog coats, and dishcloths. This past March, the Association of Fundraising Professionals recognized Jonah with a William R. Sims Award for Outstanding Youth in Philanthropy, which, quote, "honors young people with the proven record of exceptional generosity, who demonstrate outstanding civic and charitable responsibility, and whose philanthropy encourages others to engage on a community national and or international level," end quote. In a statement after receiving the award, Jonah said, quote, "philanthropy doesn't require a talent or platform, but rather an understanding that each of us can contribute with a giving heart. You can even start with something as simple as a ball of yarn and a hook, as in my case," end quote. I see there here that he is also available to be seen on YouTube. His Instagram is at Jonah Hands. Our next one from Nice News is written by Brittany Vargas. This one was archived from 2022. It came out in July of that year. It says here, this article was updated on September 6th, 2023. Title, Meet the NFL Player Turned Neurosurgeon. Myron Rolls' secret to achieving his myriad accomplishments, being named a Rhodes Scholar to study at Oxford, playing in the NFL, and pursuing a career as a neurosurgeon, is taking things one step at a time. He spent two seasons in the NFL with the Tennessee Titans and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and is now a senior neurosurgery resident at Harvard Medical School, according to USA Today. His next stop will be a residency at Massachusetts General Hospital before he pursues a one-year fellowship for pediatric neurosurgery. The 36-year-old details his journey in his recent book, The 2% Way, How a Philosophy of Small Improvements Took Me to Oxford, the NFL, and Neurosurgery. Part memoir, part motivational manual, the book describes how his principles of hard work, faith, and family values brought him to prestigious schools, earned him scholarships, and launched his career in the NFL and medicine. His philosophy? Aim for small daily improvements rather than revolutionary changes, and watch how, with persistence and faith, they transform your life. He models handling obstacles with grace, never resting on your laurels, and aligning to a path of purpose. Quote, I said, look, I have to keep moving forward. 2% at a time. Keep pressing. End quote. Rawl told the Tallahassee Democrat, explaining how he got through life's harder moments. Quote, then, when you actually sit back and write about it, and you start to think about your feelings, emotions, and thoughts through that, and how other people may face the same challenges, it really puts everything back into perspective, end quote. He continued, quote, I think we wanted to make this book one where you can find yourself in my story, in my journey, and then take from it the 2% way process of improving yourself, edifying yourself daily, and mitigating some of those challenges we all face, end quote. Rawl, who learned the 2% philosophy from his college football coach, has also pursued the extraordinary. Growing up in New Jersey, he was a star football player and was offered about 80 scholarships before attending Florida State University, where he received the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship. He then delayed his career in the NFL to get a master's in medical anthropology at Oxford University. It's an understatement to say that Rawl was both brains and brawn, yet his down-to-earth, genuine, and kind nature is what makes him so relatable. He told the Democrat, quote, the self-doubt, the insecurity, the family issues, the spiritual dilemma, the workplace challenges, that's why I think the value of the 2% way is so important. They, readers, really get a deep dive into some of my mental inner workings during a time when the hardest moments hit. End quote. Rawl's work as a philanthropist might just be the most inspiring part of his story. As a doctor, he was on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic, was part of the global disaster response team for Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas, and created a foundation to help bring health and healing to the most vulnerable. The foundation includes a wellness and leadership academy for foster children, plus an initiative to address systemic healthcare gaps in Caribbean nations by improving policy, clinical advancement, and the surgical system. His mission is to help improve the lives of as many people as possible. The foundation's website reads, quote, walk, talk, and act like you have a future. Moving next to the MIT Technology Review. This was written by Abdullahi Tassani and was published March 15th this year. The title, Africa's Push to Regulate AI Starts Now. AI is expanding across the continent and new policies are taking shape, but poor digital infrastructure and regulatory bottlenecks could slow adoption. In the Zanzibar archipelago, pardon me, of Tanzania archipelago, rural farmers are using an AI-assisted app called Nuru that works in their native language of Swahili to detect a devastating cassava disease before it spreads. In South Africa, computer scientists have built machine learning models to analyze the impact of racial segregation in housing. And in Nairobi, Kenya, AI classifies images from thousands of surveillance cameras perched on lampposts in the bustling city's center. The projected benefit of AI adoption on Africa's economy is tantalizing. Estimates suggest that four African countries alone, Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, and South Africa, could rake in up to $136 billion worth of economic benefits by 2030 if businesses there begin using more AI tools. Now, the African Union, made up of 55 member nations, is preparing an ambitious AI policy that envisions an Africa-centric path for the development and regulation of this emerging technology. But debates on when AI regulation is warranted and concerns about stifling innovation could pose a roadblock, while a lack of AI infrastructure could hold back the technology's adoption. Quote, "We're seeing a growth of AI in the continent. It's really important there be set rules in place to govern these technologies," end quote, says Chinasa T. Okolo, a fellow in the Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings, whose research focuses on AI governance and policy development in Africa. Some African countries have already begun to formulate their own legal and policy frameworks for AI. Seven have developed national AI policies and strategies, which are currently at different stages of implementation. On February 29th, the African Union Development Agency published a policy draft that lays out a blueprint for AI regulations for African nations. The draft includes recommendations for industry-specific codes and practices, standards and certification bodies to assess and benchmark AI systems, regulatory sandboxes for safe testing of AI, and the establishment of national AI councils to oversee and monitor responsible deployment of AI. The heads of African governments are expected to eventually endorse the continental AI strategy, but not until February 2025, when they meet next at AU's annual summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Countries with no existing AI policies or regulations would then use this framework to develop their own national strategies, while those that already have will be encouraged to review and align their policies with the AU's. Elsewhere, major AI laws and policies are also taking shape. This week, the European Union passed the AI Act, set to become the world's first comprehensive AI law. In October, the United States issued an executive order on AI, and the Chinese government is eyeing a sweeping AI law similar to the EU's, while also setting rules that target specific AI products as they are developed. If African countries don't develop their own regulatory frameworks that protect citizens from the technology's misuse, some experts worry that Africans will face social harms, including bias that could exacerbate inequalities. And if these countries don't also find a way to harness AI's benefits, others fear these economies could be left behind. We want to be standard makers. Some African researchers think it's too early to be thinking about AI regulation. The industry is still nascent there due to the high cost of building data infrastructure, limited internet access, a lack of funding, and a dearth of powerful computers needed to train AI models. A lack of access to quality training data is also a problem. African data is largely concentrated in the hands of companies outside of Africa. In February, just before the AU's AI policy draft came out, Chico Gitao, a computer scientist who started the Nairobi-based AI research lab, Qubit Hub, published a paper arguing that Africa should prioritize the development of an AI industry before trying to regulate the technology. Quote, "If we start by regulating, we're not going to figure out the innovations and opportunities that exist for Africa," end quote, says David Lemayin, a software engineer and one of the paper's co-authors. Okolo, who consulted on the AU AI draft policy, disagrees. "Africa should be proactive in developing regulations," says Okolo. She suggests African countries reform existing laws, such as policies on data privacy and digital governance, to address AI. But Gitao is concerned that a hasty approach to regulating AI could hinder adoption of the technology, and she says it's critical to build homegrown AI with applications tailored for Africans to harness the power of AI to improve economic growth. She says, quote, "Before we put regulations in place, we need to do the hard work of understanding the full spectrum of the technology and invest in building the African AI ecosystem," end quote. More than 50 countries and the EU have AI strategies in place, and more than 700 AI policy initiatives have been implemented since 2017. But only 5 of those initiatives are from Africa, and none of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's 38 member countries are African. Africa's voices and perspectives have largely been absent from global discussions on AI governance and regulation, says Melody Musoni, a policy and digital governance expert at an independent policy think tank in Brussels called ECDPM. Musoni said, quote, "We must contribute our perspectives and own our regulatory frameworks. We want to be standard makers, not standard takers," end quote. Nyaling Muroso, pardon me, that's Murosi, a specialist in ethics and fairness in machine learning, who is based in Xotse, Lesotho, and works at the Distributed AI Research Institute, says that some African countries are already seeing labor exploitation by AI companies. This includes poor wages and lack of psychological support for data labelers, who are largely from low-income countries but working for big tech companies. She argues regulation is needed to prevent that and to protect communities against misuse by both large corporations and authoritarian governments. In Libya, autonomous lethal weapons systems have already been used in fighting, and in Zimbabwe, a controversial military-driven national facial recognition scheme has raised concerns over the technology's alleged use as a surveillance tool by the government. The draft AU-AI policy didn't explicitly address the use of AI by African governments for national security interests, but it acknowledges that there could be perilous AI risks. Barbara Glover, program officer for an African Union group that works on policies for emerging technologies, points out that the policy draft recommends that African countries invest in digital and data infrastructure and collaborate with the private sector to build investment funds to support AI startups and innovation hubs on the continent. Unlike the EU, the AU lacks the power to enforce sweeping policies and laws across its member states. Even if the draft AI strategy wins endorsement of parliamentarians at the AU's assembly next February, African nations must then implement the continental strategy through national AI policies and laws. Meanwhile, tools powered by machine learning will continue to be deployed, raising ethical questions and regulatory needs and posing a challenge for policymakers across the continent. Murosi says Africa must develop a model for local AI regulation and governance which balances the localized risks and rewards. She says, quote, "If it works with people and works for people, then it has to be regulated," End quote. And for the final article, we turn to blacknews.com. This was posted Friday, March 15th. They don't give me an author's name here, written by their staff. Only black female pilot from an HBCU program now flying for a commercial airline. Gabrielle Harding, a graduate of Hampton University, is indeed the only black female pilot from an HBCU program that is currently flying for a commercial airline. She recently reached a significant milestone as she led an all-female crew on a United Airlines flight, marking a remarkable moment in aviation during Women's History Month. Captain Harding earned her bachelor's degree in flight education and is notably part of the esteemed Hampton Six, an elite group of Hampton graduates who are now captains at United, where she is the only woman among them. She's also one of only two black women line check pilots at United Airlines, and the first and only for the Boeing fleet. Earlier this month, Harding led a United Airlines flight that made history with an all-female crew on Flight 1215 from Newark, New Jersey to Sarasota, Florida, and back. Joining Harding on this historic flight is First Officer Julia Ewalevo, embarking on her first flight with United Airlines. Formerly a flight attendant with Frontier Airlines, Ewalevo transitioned to the flight deck, honing her skills with Endeavor before joining United. Beyond the cockpit, the entire flight is supported by an all-women team, including flight attendants, customer service representatives, and ramp services personnel. United Airlines recognized the significance of this moment and organized a reception to honor the departing and returning flights. The event garnered support from the company's women and black employee business resource groups, highlighting the collective effort to promote diversity and inclusion in aviation. Captain Harding, with over three decades of flying experience, emphasizes the importance of inspiring future generations. She told ROINJ, quote, "It's important to highlight these occasions to help inspire the next generation of women aviators. I hope any young girl seeing this story believes they can achieve their dreams if they put their mind to it." And that closes us out just a little bit early this week. Nevertheless, that's all we have time for now. And thank you so much for joining us for the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.